Good morning. It's my pleasure to again introduce our speaker this morning. She has a very small subject she wants to talk about, and I think it will be very interesting. Lynn got her bachelor's degree from Brandeis in chemistry, but as like other people I know, she went for her PhD at MIT in physics. She then did a postdoc. Oh, for her thesis, she discovered pulsations from the first X-ray transients and was able to show that this was due to a binary system. So it was a very nice piece of work. She was then a postdoc at UC Berkeley and worked on the staff there for 5 years before she became a professor at Sonoma State in 1956, where she is now chairman of the department.
Whatever.
Some days. Also among her interests are special educational programs in the area of physics. And she is the director and founder of a NASA-supported education and public outreach program at Sonoma State. Yet she has been able to do all these things and keep up with her research in X-ray and gamma-ray telescopes investigating neutron stars. Her resume is quite long, but rather than go through all of that, I'd rather give her the time to speak to us, but I'd like to point out one of her accomplishments that, as a former professor, I think is very notable. In 1993, she was the Sonoma State University Outstanding Professor, and in addition, the California Professor of the Year. I think that's quite an accomplishment. Lynn, what do we know about the universe?
Thanks, Phil. Okay, is everything working right? Am I standing in the right place? I had so many instructions, I might get a little confused here. Well, it's lovely to see such a great turnout on a wintry morning. So I'm going to try to tell you what it is that we know about the universe and how we make the measurements that have showed us these things. So this is a talk about cosmology, not a subject I usually try to talk to public audiences about. So I hope that I get to the right level with all of you. Let's just get started here. So here's just the facts. And then I'm going to back up and I'm going to explain to you how we know all of these facts. So fact number one, structures in the universe are arranged in a hierarchy, right? Little things clump into bigger things and clump into even bigger things. The universe is expanding. The age of the universe is 13.7 billion years. The universe is spatially flat, and most of the stuff in the universe is in the form of things we cannot see and that we don't understand. Okay, so hopefully by the end of the talk, you'll understand a little bit more about why we don't understand them. All right, so let's start with fact number one. Structures in the universe are arranged hierarchically. So the way we figure this out is, we survey the objects in the universe using telescopes at all different wavelengths of light. And as time goes by and we get more and more money, we build bigger and bigger telescopes. Okay, we also, besides just looking at the objects and taking images of them, we measure the speeds at which they're moving to figure out if the objects that look like they're in a group are actually gravitationally bound to each other. Okay, so I know that you're familiar with constellations in the sky. Most of the constellations that we see are just patterns that our eyes pick out. Those stars, although they look like they're related to each other because our brains see them that way, have nothing whatsoever to do with each other. They're all at different distances. They're not gravitationally attracted to each other or even stuck together or orbiting around each other. Okay, but we can figure out which things are actually orbiting around each other, which things are parts of groups, by measuring their speeds and their distances. So how do we do that? How do we measure the speed? Okay, so you probably have heard of the Doppler shift. Doppler shift is a physics phenomenon that works for both sound waves and light waves. So the sound wave version would be the version that you would be familiar with. For example, like a police siren or a, you know, ambulance going by, as it's coming towards you, the pitch sounds higher, and as it's going away from you, the pitch sounds lower. Well, the same thing happens with light. Light that's coming from an object that's moving towards you, or if its object is holding still and you're moving towards the object, doesn't matter. That pitch or color will get higher, which is called blue, because blue light has a higher energy and a higher frequency than red light. If the objects are moving away from you, that's called a red shift, or the light is shifted to the lower energies or the reddish end of the spectrum. Okay, so we can measure the Doppler shifts of the objects that are out there in space. So here's an example using pictures. So every chemical element that's in a star or in a laboratory on the ground has specific spectral lines. They're like cosmic fingerprints that astronomers use to identify those elements. And so you can measure the position, the energies of those lines. See, here's some lines. You can measure those in the laboratory, and you can figure out what their energies are. And then you can measure them looking at a star or a galaxy that's far out in space. And so here's some that are at the same place, and here's some that are shifted to the red. See how all these lines down here go that way compared to the laboratory object? Okay, so here's the laboratory line, and here's the star line. See here, this one is that way, this one is that way. See, they're all shifted a little bit to the red. These ones really do line up. These ones are all shifted. Okay, so that's how astronomers measure the red shift, which tells you the speed that the object is moving away from you. Okay, so that's how we measure speed of objects in space. So, now about the hierarchy. So we live in a solar system. We have one star, our sun. We have, well, it used to be 9 planets. Now I guess it's only 8. Depends how you feel about Pluto these days. The sun is the central object in our solar system. It has almost all the mass in the solar system. And we use some physics equations called Kepler's laws to figure out the mass of all the objects that are orbiting around our sun. Okay, so there's equations that tell you that objects at a certain distance and are going a certain speed, you can measure the mass of those objects. And in our solar system, all the objects are gravitationally bound to the sun. That's what it means to orbit around something. The only things that might not be gravitationally bound to the sun is an occasional comet. Some of them are, because some of them come back again, right? Like Halley's Comet. Other comets just come in once, and then they leave the solar system. They're not gravitationally bound to the sun. So that's the smallest hierarchy in our universe, is our solar system that we're part of. Okay, so here's a little picture of it. So there's the sun, and there's the planets, and, you know, there's Jupiter and Saturn, and then, you know, here's a comet. And here's the distance in kilometers, okay? So this would be 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000, 5 billion kilometers, or 5.9 billion kilometers across this picture. That's pretty far, right? That's really pretty far. People mostly think the solar system is a lot smaller than it is, and they think stars are a lot closer to us than they really are. So if we go out the next step, our sun is just one, you know, rather boring, actually, star. Out of at least 100 billion in our own galaxy. Okay, and our galaxy is part of a local group of galaxies that includes a very pretty galaxy that you've seen a lot of pictures of called M31 or Andromeda. Now, all of the galaxies in our group are gravitationally bound to each other, which means they're all orbiting around each other. So this isn't just planets orbiting around a star or stars orbiting around the center of our galaxy. This is entire galaxies orbiting around each other, common center of mass. None of the galaxies are actually moving fast enough to be able to escape this local group of galaxies. And some of them, like Andromeda, are actually moving towards us. And so Andromeda is one of the only objects in the sky that's actually blue shifted when we look at it, because it's moving towards us and not away from us. So here's a picture of our local group of galaxies. So here's the Milky Way galaxy, and the sun is about there. It's about two-thirds of the way across from the center of the galaxy out towards one of the arms. And here's distances to some of the other galaxies in our group. Then there's M31. That's the big, pretty spiral galaxy that you usually see pictures of. So that's even further, right? So thousands, millions, billions, trillions. I'm not sure what comes after that. And then, since I usually use scientific notation, but it's pretty far. Maybe quadrillions, sextillions, I'm not sure. Okay. So that's just our local group. And all of those galaxies are still gravitationally bound to each other. Now you can take groups of galaxies and put them into what's called a cluster of galaxies. So clusters of galaxies are made up of many little groups of galaxies. And in a cluster of galaxies, you typically have tens or at least a thousand, but usually tens of thousands of galaxies that make up a cluster. And those are still all gravitationally bound to one another. So clusters of galaxies are the biggest stable structures in the universe. But they participate in the general overall expansion of the universe, which we will get to as our next subject. So here's the Virgo cluster, which is the closest cluster of galaxies to our local group. And it's got about 1,000 galaxies in it. And you can see them, some of them right here. So the Virgo cluster and our local group are both part of what's called the local supercluster. And that's where the hierarchy ends. The superclusters are the biggest structures in the universe, but they are not gravitationally bound. That's just a pattern that we can see made up of other clusters that are still, you know, a stable structure. The superclusters are really big. Sometimes they're filamentary. They are not gravitationally bound to one another, and that's where the hierarchy stops. So there's nothing bigger scale in our universe than a supercluster. And we have measured the positions of millions and millions of galaxies and their distances. So here, here's just our local supercluster. So here's the Virgo cluster that we're sort of part of. And here's some other groups. And here's our local group here. And you can see this is really getting to be a pretty big scale now. But not anywhere big as the whole universe. Okay, so all of the distances that I showed you in those slides before were measured from the Doppler shifts, okay? The velocities and the relationship of these objects were all measured by using this Doppler shift technique. But just because we know the velocity of an object, how does that tell us about the distance to the object? Okay, that was something that Edwin Hubble figured out. And, of course, he was so famous, they named the Hubble Space Telescope after him and a couple other interesting laws and constants. How did Hubble figure out that you could use this redshift, this Doppler shift, to figure out the distance to an object? Okay, well, this wasn't actually it. Okay, the Big Bang didn't really happen exactly that way. Okay, so what he really saw was back in the beginning of the 1900s, around 1910 or 1920, he started using a very big telescope at the time, and was looking at these fuzzy blobs out in space. Now, at that point, they just called all these fuzzy blobs nebulae. Nobody actually knew what these nebulae were. They just looked like fuzzy blobs. But he had a telescope that was good enough that he could tell that these fuzzy blobs looked like collections of stars. But yet, they were not the stars in our own galaxy. They looked like entire other galaxies. Now, how could he show that? Well, he was able to see individual stars within each one of these fuzzy blobs that varied periodically in brightness. And some of the stars in our own galaxy seemed to vary the same way. Now, he could use parallax to figure out the distances to the stars in our own galaxy. And if you don't know what parallax is, hold your thumb up and close one eye, and then close the other eye, and you'll see your thumb move. It'll shift from side to side. So parallax is how you tell the distance to something by looking at it from two different points of view. Okay? And the shift that you see in the object's position tells you the distance, or in this case, the length of my arm, right? And the same thing works with stars that we can see move in the sky compared to stars that are really, really far away that we don't see move. So the very nearest stars to us will actually shift when the Earth is on one side of the sun in the summer and the other side of the sun in the winter as it goes around its orbit. The positions of the nearby stars will actually move. And we can look at that parallax shift to figure out the distances to those nearby ones. So some of these periodic stars were close enough for us to measure using parallax. And then there were some of these periodic stars that seemed to be in these fuzzy blobs that were really far away. Okay, so in 1923, he started studying these stars with the Mount Wilson 100-inch telescope to look at the stars in the nebulae called Andromeda, which is the big galaxy I was talking about earlier. And he saw this periodic variation. And the brightness of the star, the luminosity, looked like it went the period of the variation to this 1.3 power, which you can sort of ignore. But what he figured out was that the absolute brightness of the star could be determined by looking at the period of the variability. And if you know the absolute brightness of something, you can figure out how far away it is. For example, if you know that a light bulb is 100 watts, and you put it across the room, and you measure how much light you're getting on this end of the room, you can figure out the size of the room by seeing that it isn't, you know, it's 100 watts there at the light bulb, but it's not 100 watts where you are at this side of the room, right? If you move that light bulb a factor of four away, a factor of two further away, its brightness will go down by a factor of four, because the brightness goes down like the square of the distance. So he figured out that these stars, these periodically varying Cepheid stars, were the astronomical equivalent of a 100-watt light bulb, something that we call a standard candle. Okay, you know the intrinsic brightness of the thing, so wherever you put it, you see how bright it looks, and you can figure out the distance to that object. So that was how Hubble figured out the distance to the first nebulae, which he then figured out was actually a galaxy filled with other stars similar to our own galaxy. It turns out that some supernovae can also be used as standard candles, and I'll talk about them when I get towards the end of the talk. Okay, so here's the famous law that got named after Hubble, Hubble's law. And what it says is, if you measure the velocity of the star using the Doppler shift, that it's Hubble's constant times its distance, or the speed of light times its redshift. Okay, so redshift is the fractional amount that those lines have moved in that spectrum. And then Hubble's constant is something that you measure in kilometers per second per millions of parsecs. And a parsec is 3 light years. So that's sort of a weird unit. But what it says is, for every million parsecs you go out, how much faster the objects are moving away from you. And Hubble's constant is about 71. So if you go out a million parsecs, the things that are at that distance are moving away from you at 71 kilometers per second. If you go out 2 million parsecs, they're moving away from you at 142 kilometers per second. And it keeps going. The further away you go, the faster the objects are moving away from you. And so that is evidence for the general expansion of the universe, what's sometimes called the Hubble flow. And so here's a little picture of a piece of the universe with some galaxies in it. And here it is expanding, and here's the same galaxies. Now, this is a very important point. Notice, the galaxies didn't expand. Only the space between the galaxies expanded. The galaxies themselves don't expand, and people in this room don't expand, unless, of course, they eat too much because it's Christmas time, because they're gravitationally bound. So that's why I was making a big deal before about the fact that certain structures are gravitationally bound. If they're bound to each other, they don't expand. They just stay the same. It's the space between the structures that expands. So the galaxies stay the same size. The clusters of galaxies stay the same size. The superclusters, on the other hand, they expand because they're not gravitationally bound. Okay, so here's a galaxy map that shows, oh, I don't know, at least a million galaxies. It's color-coded for their distances. And this was taken in the infrared because visible light, the part of the light that we see with our eyes, if you start getting really far away, the visible light from the galaxy's redshifts down below that into the infrared. So this is actually an infrared map of a bunch of galaxies. And you can see some things with colors are all at the same distances. If they have the same color, those are structures. And you can see the filamentary structures of some of these superclusters. These things that all have the same colors are all about at the same distance as each other. You can see the filaments of the supercluster. And this is our galaxy here across the middle. This is the whole sky. This is looking out of our galaxy towards the north, looking out of our galaxy towards the south. This point is the same as this point. So it's like you were outside on a really dark night, which I'm pretty sure it gets dark enough here to see the Milky Way galaxy, and you lined up the middle there with the sky, and you sort of stretched this whole thing around yourself, like, you know, it's like a big orange, and then you unpeeled it and put it down like a map. Okay, so this point and this point are really the same. This is north and this is south. And that's our Milky Way galaxy in the middle. Okay, so now I just gave you the first evidence for the universe expanding. And that's this general measurement by Edwin Hubble that as he looked out at further and further galaxies, they were moving away from us faster and faster. So using Hubble's law, we can measure the recession velocities of all the galaxies. That gives us the distances to them. And beyond our local group, all the galaxies are moving away from us. Only a couple in our local group are moving towards us. The galaxies are not changing size. It's the space between them that's expanding. And despite what we may think, we are not the center of the universe. Okay, so now, on to the next fact. The universe is 13.7 billion years old. That's a pretty precise number, so how did we get that? Okay, well, it took some modern satellites to pin it down that well. But here's the simple version. If everything is expanding away from everything else, if you run the clock backwards, you see, and if it's all going at the same rate, you run the clock backwards and you see how long it took before everything was at the same point, right? It's like running a movie backwards. You break a cup, the pieces fly apart, and then you run the movie backwards and the pieces all come back together again. Right? So how long was it, if you run the clock backwards, until all the pieces were in the same place? And it turns out that that's actually the inverse of the Hubble constant, and that gives you 14 billion years.
That's always possibly a bit, because the fact that we're our time has to do with the rotation of the Earth, or something's happening in our galaxy, or our solar system. Whereas 13.7 billion years ago, there was no solar system.
Okay, so the question was, I've always been puzzled by this because he thinks our time is related to measurements that we make in our solar system, and 13.7 billion years ago, there was no solar system because our solar system actually was only formed about 5 billion years ago. Okay, that's correct, but it's not correct that the time has anything to do with our solar system. Time, the way we measure time is actually, most recently, the standards of time have been based on the frequencies of atomic transitions of hydrogen. So one of those chemical fingerprints that I was telling you about. Now, it's convenient for us to measure years and days having to do with our solar system, but that, you know, those years and days are defined in the standard units of time that are measured by looking at these, you know, physical or chemical constants, because they had to pick something. I mean, a long time ago that was true, but they had to pick something that would be true no matter what happened with the Earth in its orbit and no matter what happened with, you know, gravitational changes, you know, that are local, right? We need a universal standard of time that can be agreed on, even, you know, by, like, cosmic beings that might come to visit us. Okay, the question is, if space is expanding constantly, how long does it take before the galaxies disappear from our vision? That's a really good question, and I'm going to talk about that later. So just hold that thought. Okay, so if we do the simple thing, and we just run the clock backwards, and we assume that the expansion has always been at the same rate, we get 14 billion. Not exactly 13.7 billion. So what's going on there? What is Hubble's constant really constant? In other words, has the expansion always been at exactly the same rate since the beginning of the Big Bang? Okay, so in order to refine this estimate further, we have to know the detailed expansion history of the universe. We have to know whether the universe really has been expanding at exactly the same rate since the Big Bang. And it turns out that it has not been. Okay, Hubble's constant is just the value that we measure today when we look at the expansion and the general recession of these other galaxies. So how do we measure the actual history of the expansion? You know, if it's slowed down or if it's sped up or, you know, what's going on with it? Okay, well, in order to figure out how we do that, we have to understand the different kinds of light that we see in the universe and what is the most distant light that we can actually see. Okay, it's not the galaxies that I've been telling you about. The most distant light that we can see is called the cosmic microwave background. And this is light that comes from about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Okay, so 13.7 billion minus 300,000, that long ago. And the cosmic microwave background comes from all of the light that was left over when the universe had expanded enough so that atoms started to form. Okay, so in the beginning, when you had the Big Bang, there was just a lot of heat and light, and as the universe expanded, things cooled off, and at a certain point, things got cool enough that particles started to form, and the particles started to clump into atoms. And at that point, the light wasn't streaming freely through the universe anymore, and so we still see that light. It's sort of trapped at that point. Now, it was discovered in 1965 by these two guys, Penzias and Wilson, and they were working at Bell Labs in New Jersey with this weird-looking telescope here. This is a microwave telescope. And they kept pointing it at different parts of the sky, and they kept seeing this noise in the telescope, even when they didn't think they were looking at anything. And there were pigeons nesting in there, so they cleaned it out because they thought maybe the pigeon poop was making noise in their telescope, which it was not. And down the street from them at Princeton, there were some theorists that had predicted that there would be this leftover signal from the Big Bang, this sort of cooling embers, relic light from the initial explosion that should be detectable. And they were working on their own experiments, but they got scooped by these guys. So that was in 1965, and then it took another, 40 years or so for some folks to figure out how to launch one of those weird-looking telescopes. It's in there, actually. On a satellite that would orbit the Earth. And the satellite was called COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer. And the fellow who did this recently got the Nobel Prize, George Smoot. He's at UC Berkeley. I know him. He also won $1 million on Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? It was, I would certainly hope that someone that could win a Nobel Prize in physics would be smarter than a fifth grader. He just did that for fun and to get the money so he could put more of it into education. He's a quite a fun guy. Anyway, he discovered that there were actual little fluctuations in the intensity of the microwave background. And those fluctuations are the seeds of the structure that we now see. So this is the map that he made that won him the Nobel Prize in 2006. And when he discovered this and when he announced the discovery, he called these the wrinkles on the face of God. So this is the same kind of map that I showed you before where our galaxy is across the middle, but you can't see the galaxy in this one, can you? Okay, that's because they took it out. So this is all the little things that were left over once they removed the galaxy. And the differences in temperature between the blue ones, which are cooler, and the red ones, which are hotter, is only a few hundred millionths of a degree. Okay, a few hundred microkelvin. So he had to measure the microwave background very precisely. But if everything was totally smooth, then nothing would have clumped together. And then you wouldn't have ever gotten atoms. And then you would have never gotten stars. And you would have never gotten galaxies. Right? Because you needed to have some places that were a little cooler and some places that were a little warmer so the cooler ones could clump together. Or we would not be here having this discussion. Okay, and the other fellow that got the Nobel Prize with him was John Mather, and he measured the temperature of the radiation, and it's 2.7 Kelvin, which was something that was predicted. So when the Big Bang happened, and it was really, really hot and dense, the temperature was billions of Kelvin. By the time things had expanded enough that stuff started to clump together to make atoms, the temperature had cooled down to only about 3 Kelvin, 2.7. Okay, so now why is it important to look at the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background? Well, it turns out that the size of those spots that you can measure tells you something about the geometry of the universe. And so here's an example. If you have spots that are about this big, you have a flat universe. If you have spots that are, in general, bigger, then that means that so much stuff is around that clumped together that the universe is closed, that the expansion will not continue forever because you've got a lot of gravity there that will pull it back together again. On the other hand, if you just have little tiny spots like this, the universe has not got enough matter in it to stop the expansion, and it will expand forever. Okay, so that's what the sizes of those spots have to do with the geometry of the universe. So a new satellite was launched. In fact, it just finished its observations. They just turned it off this year by someone that went to graduate school with me, Chuck Bennett. He was one of my classmates at MIT. And his satellite was called the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, WMAP. And WMAP had the next generation of microwave instruments that were much higher resolution. And this is the map that they made. And it looks a lot like the COBE map, but now you've got the spots resolved to as well as they can actually be resolved. So COBE was sort of a blurry picture of the wrinkles, and here we now see, you know, HDTV version of the wrinkles. Okay, and so it turns out that you can now have enough information to actually measure the spot size. What is the average spot size in all of these little fluctuations? It turns out it's about 1 degree. And 1 degree is the spot size predicted from a perfectly flat universe. Okay, geometrically flat universe. Now, that doesn't mean that things aren't expanding and that we still can't think of it as spherical. This is the part that gets to be a little abstract and hard to understand, if the rest of it wasn't. Okay, what a geometrically flat universe means is that if you have two beams of light and they're going out in parallel, they will stay parallel forever. Okay, if you're on the surface of the Earth, which is a sphere, and you have two parallel beams of light, they're going to cross, right? Just like the lines of longitude cross. Okay, they're going to curve. So if you have a closed universe, like a sphere, like the Earth, if you're on the surface of the Earth and you send out two parallel beams of light, they will curve because of the Earth's curvature and cross. That's not true if you have a geometrically flat universe. A geometrically flat universe, the two beams of light stay parallel forever. Okay, so what I totally left out, because it's even more confusing than the stuff I've been discussing, is inflation at the very beginning of the universe. So if people want to ask questions about inflation later, feel free. But if I now had a digression into inflation, I would not be able to finish this talk anywhere near close to being on time. So I'll put that one off. So if you look at the detailed analysis of these spot sizes from the WMAP data, and you put that together with the measurements of all of the velocities of everything, you get the cosmic pie chart right there, which on this screen looks a little squashed. But here's the cosmic pie chart, and you can figure out, with a perfectly flat universe and making measurements with many different kinds of satellites, what is the stuff in the universe. So you may not realize this, but the stuff that we're made of, which is mostly the heavy elements like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and hydrogen and helium that are in the stars, and hydrogen and helium that are floating out there in space, and even some neutrinos, this stuff is only about 5% of the whole universe. When you look at all the matter and energy that's out in the universe, the stuff that we're made of, everything that we're familiar with, is only 5% of it. That's a sort of a humbling thought. Okay. It turns out that we can measure the effects of dark matter which I'm going to get to in the next slides. And the dark matter is about 25% of the stuff in the universe. Well, we don't know very much about it, but at least we know a little bit. The stuff we really know nothing about is the other 70% of the universe, which they call dark energy because it sort of sounded good and it was sort of like dark matter, and then people can make a lot of jokes about the dark side of the universe. But we know even less about that. So now let me talk to you about these things that we know very little about. And that's the last part of this. Most of this stuff in the universe is things we can't see and we don't understand. So dark matter is stuff that you can feel but you can't see. It doesn't emit any light. It doesn't absorb any light. But it interacts gravitationally with other objects in the universe. Okay, so we can measure that it's there, just like we can measure the mass of the planets going around the sun, because we see the effect that they have on the sun and we see the effect that the sun has on them. Dark energy, on the other hand, is the mysterious force that's causing the expansion, the Hubble flow, of the universe to accelerate. So not only is the universe expanding, like we discussed before, every million parsecs it goes another 70 kilometers per second faster, but as you go further away, it's going even faster than that. It's expanding faster and faster. The acceleration is the expansion is accelerating. We know very, very little about that one. Okay, so now let me tell you about dark matter, which is something at least that we have lots of different experimental evidence for. Going all the way back to the 1930s, when Fritz Zwicky, who was a Caltech professor, was looking at the galaxies in a cluster of galaxies called Coma, he discovered that the galaxies were moving too fast to stay bound to the cluster if you just thought that the amount of matter in the cluster was what you could see by the light from the galaxies. But yet, the cluster was gravitationally stable. So if you measure all the mass in the galaxies by looking at the light from the galaxies, and then you measure all the speeds of the galaxies by looking at their Doppler shifts, and the thing is not falling apart, not blowing apart, something else must be holding it together that you can't see. It's not making light. So that was the first experimental evidence for dark matter. Since then, there's been a lot of other things that that have given astronomers evidence for dark matter. For example, in 1970, Vera Rubin, the Carnegie Observatory, discovered that when she measured the speed of the gas in the stars in the outer parts of the galaxy, 30,000 parsecs or 100,000 light years away from the center, compared to the speed in the center, the stuff in the outer parts was going too fast. It should, in fact, be slowing down. And it wasn't. See, it's flat there. So that implies that there's some extra mass, even in a galaxy. So now it's not just a huge cluster of galaxies, it's extra mass even within an individual galaxy that's holding the stars in. Or the stars in the outer parts of the galaxy would be leaving, which they don't. Okay, and so we don't see that mass even in our own galaxy, and so the name dark matter was chosen for that. Okay, so lots of good experimental evidence for dark matter. There's other evidence, for example, if you look at clusters of galaxies in X-rays, then what you see is you can measure all the mass of the light that's making the X-rays, and it's actually more gas between the galaxies in the cluster than there are mass in the galaxies that would be holding the gas in. It's off by a factor of 5. So those clusters of galaxies have to have dark matter, as I mentioned before. Okay, so back to the Hubble expansion. So we can look at the galaxies and we can see that they're moving faster as we go further away. And we can measure the Hubble constant at our present time. But we would try to figure out what will the future, right? We did the expansion history of the universe. Now what about the expansion future of the universe? Okay, so remember back when I was telling you about the Cepheid variables and they were standard candles, like 100-watt light bulbs for astronomers? And I mentioned that you could use supernovae as standard candles also. So a supernova is a big explosion that happens at the end of the life of a star about 20 times as big as ours. Our star won't do this, so don't worry. If you take a much bigger star, it will, when it runs out of fuel in its core at the end of its life, the inner part of the core collapses down, and then the outer layers go down and they hit the core and then they bounce back off again and they blow out, and that's called a supernova. So there are many different kinds of supernovae. There's one particular kind called the type 1A that can be used as a standard candle because it's the same kind of star that's blowing up, and we know how massive it is, and it's always the same mass. And so we know how much light it gives off, and it's always the same amount of intrinsic light. So the great thing about having a supernova as your standard candle is that you can see them. They're so bright, you can see them much further away than those Cepheid variables. So the Cepheid variables only get us out to galaxies that aren't all that far away, and we'd like to get measuring things closer to the observable edge of the universe. And so we can use the type 1A supernovae to do this. And some of them happen in the same galaxies with the Cepheid variables, so that's how we can calibrate the two things. But then you can see the supernovae in further away galaxies where you can't see the individual stars anymore. And it turns out that the light curve, the decay time of the supernova, because it's really bright when it blows up and then it gets less bright as it stops, you know, as it cools off, the decay time of that light curve gives you a measure of its absolute luminosity. So just like the variations in the Cepheid variables told you the absolute luminosity, the light curve of the supernova tells you its absolute luminosity. And it's good to at least 20%, maybe even a little better now. So this is what we do. We take a spectrum of something, the supernova, and we measure the redshift of the lines, and that gives us one version of the distance. And then we take this light curve of the supernova as its light decays, this is days, as the brightness of the thing decays as a function of time. And then we compare these two measures of distance to see if the expansion rate has stayed the same or if it has not. Right? So it's two different ways of measuring the same thing. If they totally agree, then the expansion rate is still the Hubble rate. And if they don't, then we're learning something. And then the people that started to do this work with the supernovae, and this was, now this is pretty recent. These first results were announced in 1998. Okay, so it's only been in the past 10 years that we've had this version of cosmology that's the currently best accepted model. The people that started studying these supernovae totally expected to see that the expansion of the universe would be slowing down. That was their preconceived notion when they went in to start getting all this data. They were absolutely astounded to find out that, in fact, the expansion of the universe was speeding up. It wasn't slowing down at all. Okay, so what they did was they analyzed the light curves versus the redshifts for many, many different type 1A supernovae. The first paper that was published was about 100 different supernovae. It took them about 7 years to get the data. There were two independent groups that did totally different sets of supernovae. And what they showed was that they're dimmer than you would have thought if the universe was expanding at a constant rate or slowing down. So, you know, you expect them to be a certain amount of brightness, and in fact, they're dim, which means they're really further away than they should have been, right? So if they're further away than they should have been, then that means the universe expanded faster than you thought it was expanding. Okay, got that? That's how you get the acceleration of the expansion. And so this was the evidence that there's some kind of extra energy in the universe, and so they called it dark energy, that's accelerating the expansion of the universe, making the universe expand faster and faster. Okay, so here's a summary of all the things that I've told you today and sort of where the different things are coming from. We live in a flat universe that mostly comes from the size of the fluctuations from WMAP. The universe is expanding at the rate of 70 kilometers per second for every million parsecs you go out. That's Hubble Space Telescope and other satellites. The age of the universe is about 13.7 billion years. That's WMAP and other satellites like Hubble. Dark matter makes up about 25% of the universe. That's lots of different measurements from the ground and satellites. And dark energy makes up the other 70%, which causes the expansion to accelerate. And so that's the supernovae plus the WMAP results. It's a pretty complicated picture. And it's really different than what people thought even 10 years ago, when the expansion rate was believed to be sort of constant or maybe slowing down. And so it's, you know, it's really an interesting thing that you can, you know, get something that so quickly astronomers will decide is the real truth when 10 years before they believed something totally different. The dark matter evidence has been around for a really long time. If you took a poll of astronomers and asked them, you know, how many people in this room think there's good experimental evidence from dark matter, probably 95% or more would say, yes, dark matter is real. We still don't know what it is, but we do think that it is out there. If you ask the same group of astronomers, do you think dark energy is real? Probably you would only get 70% or so. 50 to 70%, I'd guess. It's only 10 years old. There's only been a couple of, you know, this supernova kind of measurements and another kind of measurements that I haven't told you about, which is even harder to explain, the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And so, you know, the verdict is still out on that one, but it is the current best theory of the structure and origin and evolution of the universe at the present time. And that's how science works, right? You have a model, you do tests of the model, and then you see if you can falsify the model, right? If you can come up with one really good example that shows that your model is wrong, all you need is one really good one. You have to have a new model, right? And so this is today's model for the way that the universe is formed, its age, you know, the different things that are in it. And people are constantly working to try to falsify this model. Hasn't happened yet, and the dark energy has held up since 1998, despite people's best attempts at proving it false, because on the face of it, it does seem rather preposterous. And now I'll answer the question from the lady who asked me, are the galaxies going to disappear from our view? In an accelerating universe, the galaxies are moving away from us faster and faster. Despite the fact that Einstein's theory of special relativity says that nothing that has matter can move faster than the speed of light, that theory applies to particles that are in our universe. It doesn't apply to the universe itself. And remember, I told you that it was the space between the galaxies that's expanding, not the galaxies. So there's no laws that say that the space between the galaxies, space itself, can't expand faster than the speed of light. So what will happen if the acceleration goes unchecked for, say, another 10 billion years is that the space between the galaxies will expand faster than the speed of light, at which point the light from the galaxies will no longer be able to be seen, no matter how long you wait, because the light itself still has to go only at the speed of light. Okay, so there's no bound on how fast the universe can expand, and if someone were to ask me about the inflationary period, that was a time when the universe itself expanded much, much faster than the speed of light. Okay, so we have evidence that in the past that actually happened for the first 10 to the minus 43 seconds of the universe. Okay, so I think that was my last slide, other than to put up a bunch of web links if you want to learn more about this. My group at Sonoma State, we are developing an online class in cosmology at a general education level. We just got the funding for it. We'll be working on it for the next 3 years or so. So in a few years, you know, if you want to try to do some lifelong learning, you might be interested in checking out that class. And at that, I will close my formal presentation, and we'll go into the questions and answer session.
Thank you for everybody. My question is, with the closing down of NASA flights, that is, and it's immediately forthcoming, the last one I believe just happened, how will this affect the future of astronomy, of research? How will it affect you and your research and all the other astronomers?
Okay, so NASA is going to be stopping the space shuttle flights fairly soon. I think they may have one or two more left. I don't think they've had the last one quite. That doesn't actually affect me at all because only two satellites that I'm actually really familiar with were ever launched by the space shuttle, which is Hubble, and Compton-Gamory Observatory, which is a satellite I worked on a long time ago. Almost all the satellites that I've worked on have been launched by rockets. I don't do manned spaceflight. I'm not into the whole astronaut exploring the other planet surface kind of thing. I think this is work that's better done by robots, and it's very easy to launch satellites with robots in them on rockets. And so I think it's really great that we've got the rise of the commercial space industry now, and the folks down at SpaceX, which includes one of my former students, are building commercial rockets that can take things to the space station and can launch future satellites. Hopefully, the price of the launches will go down. It costs a lot of money for NASA to do a launch because NASA is never allowed to make mistakes, even though, of course, they do sometimes. Other space programs in other countries blow stuff up all the time, and you never really hear about it. And so, satellites are expensive. The most recent one that I have been working on, Fermi-Gamma-ray Space Telescope, cost $700 million. We really wouldn't have wanted it to blow up. But other little ones that are still worthy of being launched and that can explore things, maybe they're only $100 million. And so maybe, if you only spent $50 million on a launch instead of $100 million on a launch, you could launch more things, right? So it's a matter of scale. So I applaud the successful launch of the Falcon 9, and I'm really glad to see somebody besides NASA getting into the rocket business. I'm also very fond of rockets.
This is about the expansion. Is there any relationship that's simple that relates the rotation rates of all of these levels
Of the hierarchy?
Yeah.
Okay, so is there a relationship between the rotation of a galaxy and the expansion? And the answer is no. Okay, so the galaxies, the rotation rates of galaxies or the rotation rates of stars is really just a function of the angular momentum that was in that matter when it clumped together and shrunk down and, collapsed to form a structure. Just like if you have an ice skater and they're rotating and they have their arms out, and then when they pull their arms in, they spin faster. When you have some matter and it's just moving around a little bit, as it clumps down to form a star, the spin rate will go up and up. And so that's really just one of these fluctuation things. It's sort of the local material and what the properties were of that when it started to collapse to form a structure.
Does the name dark energy... does it really describe what it is? It seems to me like it doesn't function like the rest of the energy in the universe.
I think that's a very good observation. I don't think dark energy functions like the rest of the energy in the universe because it's sort of the opposite, right? It's sort of this repulsive force that's is pushing things apart, right? But because it's pushing things apart, it sort of acts like energy. It must have some energy. And because we have no clue what it is, they just called it dark energy. But it's not such a great name. Dark matter is probably a better name because at least it acts like matter. In other words, it has gravitational and clumping properties like matter does. If people knew more about it, maybe they could come up with a better name. But just like black hole, I think that name is stuck. And so it will probably always be called that, at least until people figure out if it's correct or not, and maybe... they figure out more about what it is, they might change the name.
Would you clarify once more what you mean by the phrase flat universe?
Okay, so just because the universe is geometrically flat doesn't mean that it looks spatially flat. So it isn't like a big plane. Okay. I might have a slide here somewhere. In fact, let me just go to my computer. It's probably a faster way to find it than... maybe not, because now I don't know where the talk went. It's not actually my computer. Okay. So it was I think they changed it into a show. Well, that's not going to work then. I have a picture that in one of my backup slides that I think is going to help with that. At least I hope I have the picture in here somewhere. Okay. So if you're... on a surface of a sphere like the Earth, you can see that things, that the lines would cross. But if you make the sphere bigger and bigger, eventually, if you're just a little ant crawling around on the surface of this really, really huge sphere, the lines are going to seem like they're parallel. Okay? So the fact that the universe looks spatially flat is in large part a fact that the universe is really, really huge. And so every measurement that we do, it looks locally flat. Now, it may be that on scales much bigger than we can observe, the thing is still some kind of a sphere. But because we're this little ant crawling around on the surface of this little tiny sphere, we don't get to see that. It just looks spatially flat to us. And so hopefully that will help. Here's another example that I like to tell my students. Before inflation, which is this huge expansion of the universe, you know, that happens in the first 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang, the theories of how big the universe was compared to what we could see were sort of like that slide. Okay? So this 10 to the 28 centimeters is how much of the universe we can see even looking back with our best telescopes. And so we thought that the universe expanded from, say, 1 centimeter to 10 to 28 centimeters within this short period of time, and then it, you know, went into the Hubble flow. Okay, so that was what we thought until we found out about inflation. In fact, what it really is like is this. So the part of the universe we can see is still the same size, but the amount of universe there really is out there is much, much, much bigger. Picture a paper plate, and it's got those little fluty edges around it, right? And it's got that middle part that's flat. So it used to be that we thought that we were seeing the universe that we could see was like the flat middle part, and we were only missing the little fluty edges, and that was the part we couldn't see that was the other, you know, stuff that was outside the range of our telescopes. With inflation, that the part that we can't see, the part that we can see is still the middle of the paper plate. The part that we can't see is as big as our entire solar system. Okay, just to put it into perspective. Okay, so we are really just a little ant crawling around on a very tiny piece of universe. And so even if it is a sphere, we can't see that. It's only going to look locally flat to us. Okay, next question.
A comment and a question. The fundamentalist said, how can I believe in science? It's always changing. I saw on BBC News a piece where Sir Roger Penrose had published a book that said, in analyzing the background COB, or whatever.
Yeah, cosmic microwave background.
They had evidence of events prior to the Big Bang. I've not seen a word anywhere since. Have you?
Okay, so Sir Roger Penrose is a very brilliant mathematician, and so I'm not going to be, you know, telling you that I know more than he does. But he can come up with great mathematical theories about how things might work, and then people can go out and look for those effects. To my knowledge, no one has seen any effects of any other, you know, Big Bang echoes in the spectrum of the microwave background. We've seen echoes of stars exploding. We see echoes of light echoes from eruptions from black holes in the centers of galaxies. But people keep looking at the stochastic background, the stochastic microwave background, and people will be studying that background with gravitational waves once gravitational wave detectors start working in another 3 years maybe. But to my knowledge, no one has actually seen any evidence of that kind of an effect yet. But it's a great prediction, and it's always great when theorists make predictions before scientists get a chance to make measurements, because those are the theorists we think are the smartest ones, the ones that can think up stuff before we discover it.
Getting back to the open and closed universe, we often think of open means it'll expand forever, closed it will expand to some certain size and then collapse, or if it's flat, it'll stay the same. Is that related to your concepts of open and closed?
So, yeah, that's an excellent question. Okay, so that picture that I showed you with the fluctuation sizes and the open, closed, and flat universe. If geometry was all that was going on in the universe, then that would be true. Okay, you have a lot of matter, the universe is closed. You don't have enough matter, the universe is open. You have exactly the right amount of matter, the universe is flat. Okay, it turns out that geometry is not destiny. And this is a quote from one of my favorite theorists, Rocky Cobb from the University of Chicago. We used to think that was true before 1998 and the discovery of dark energy. Now it is possible for the universe to be spatially flat but have the expansion be accelerating. So it's an open universe because it's going to continue to expand even though it's spatially flat. And so you actually have these two things going on at the same time that used to be things that people thought were totally different. Excellent question.
Two things. One, I wonder what you feel the level of education is in the sciences in this country, since this is obviously something that's critically important to even our survival. And then, Lynn, I was hoping you would tell them about being a rocketeer.
Okay, this is my friend Susan Muirso. I did not plant these questions. But I am glad that she came to hear me. Okay, so the level of science education in this country is pretty abysmal. As you might know, there's this thing called No Child Left Behind, which we educators usually call No Child Left Untested. And the only things they're testing are reading and math. And so pretty much since No Child Left Behind started, everyone stopped teaching science because nobody was getting tested on science. Now they're starting to test on science, and guess what they're going to find? No one's been studying science for 10 years. And so I've been doing, as Susan well knows, I've been doing a lot of work with some of the public charter schools up in Santa Rosa with after-school science clubs and just trying everything I can do to get some science into the K-12 classroom. And that's the primary mission of my NASA-funded education group, is to try to get kids hooked on the gateway drug to harder science, which is astronomy. Okay, and use astronomy as examples to get them excited about doing other kinds of science. And, you know, try to get their interest up. And another thing that I've been trying to get kids interested in is learning how to build things. And so that's where the question about the rockets come from. I've been building rockets myself. I think it's really fun. It's really exciting. I'd like to see more kids learn how to build things and get them away from just staring at computer screens and doing Facebook all the time, which, as far as what I can tell, is passing for technology education these days. You know, kids have computers. They're great at playing on computers. Can they program them? Well, not hardly. Do they know how to build circuits or build anything with their hands? Do they have any pre-engineering skills whatsoever anymore in this country? Not as far as I can tell. And I think it's really a tragedy. Because when I went to school, and I'm getting older now, but when I went to school, I went to public high school, and I learned calculus. And here at Sonoma State, we have supposedly the top third of high school students coming to the Cal State schools, and half of them need math remediation at the level of fractions, which is stuff that is an eighth grade standard. Okay? And These are supposed to be the top one-third of the high school graduates. What does that say about the bottom two-thirds of the high school students? Okay? I mean, this is just terrible, you know, that they come to college and half the students are not ready for college-level math, which means that they, you know, they're still doing fractions and they're still learning algebra, and they're not even ready for pre-calculus, which is what is considered college-level math. In my opinion, calculus should be considered college-level math, but no, it's pre-calculus. But still, they're not capable of doing it. Half of the entering students that we get at Sonoma State, and we're actually one of the more choosy of the Cal State campuses. So, you know, we have a problem here, folks. We have a problem with the education of the kids in this country if we're going to be competitive with the kids from India and China and countries where people come out of high school knowing calculus.
Seems to me that not long ago, they were saying that the universe was saddle-shaped, the one on the left.
Okay, so that's the open universe. And so in my answer to Phil's question, it's basically geometrically flat, but expanding, continuously expanding, which people would have called open back then, which is the saddle shape that you refer to. But it's not saddle-shaped. It's geometrically flat. Parallel light rays, you know, don't cross. With a saddle-shaped universe, the parallel light rays would diverge. okay, and with a closed universe that the parallel light rays would cross. So the parallel light rays, yeah, the parallel, it's Euclidean, the parallel light rays stay parallel, but the universe continues to expand, so people would call that open, even if they don't mean the same kind of open they used to mean.
On a more insignificant level, could you comment on the light show we're supposed to be able to see this week in the northern skies?
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's the Gemini meteorite shower, and it's supposed to be, I think, the December 13th and 14th, so good luck with that. Maybe it'll stop raining. I think next week is supposed to rain again. Other question over here somewhere? Here? I'm watching the mic person.
Yes, could you define and explain what a black hole is?
Okay, well, that's my other talk that I gave to the Sons in Retirement when I was here a couple of years ago. But black holes are actually one of my favorite subjects. I've spent most of my scientific career studying them in all various shapes and sizes. A black hole is an object that when you get too close to it, you can't escape from it even if you're going at the speed of light. So that's why it's called black, because even light can't escape from it. Now, we know of black holes in several different size ranges. There are black holes that have the mass that's the equivalent of 10 to 20 of our suns. So that's 10 to 20 solar mass black holes. And those are caused when you have a really, really big supernova at the end of the life of a really, really big star, and the core that's left when the star explodes has that mass of about 10 or 20 solar masses. When that collapses all the way down, the escape velocity when you get too close to it can exceed the speed of light, and so that's a stellar mass black hole. And we see at least 30 well-studied stellar mass black holes in our own galaxy, and many, many more. And they've been studied for over 30 years. And we can measure the masses of these objects because they have stars rotating around them that are stars that make visible light that we can see. And we can see how they tug on the other star from Kepler's laws, and so we can measure the mass of the black hole. And from near the black hole, we see a lot of X-rays from right outside the event horizon. And so we can study these X-rays with X-ray satellites. Now, another class of black holes are the supermassive black holes that are in the centers of galaxies like our own. Our galaxy has a 4 million solar mass black hole at its core. And bigger galaxies than ours have even bigger black holes. And there's most likely, it seems to be a very strong correlation between the mass of the galaxy and the mass of the black hole. So if you have a really, really big galaxy, you can have a billion solar mass black hole in the core. And those black holes were not formed by stars blowing up because they're too big. They're much bigger than a single star. They were probably formed when the galaxy itself formed. And so then you get into this sort of chicken and egg question, well, did a bunch of stuff clump down and make the black hole and then the galaxy formed around it because it was attracted gravitationally to the black hole? Or did the whole thing sort of, you know, make a big galaxy and then after that the center collapsed and made the black hole? And so people are trying to figure that out. But right now it sort of looks like the black holes and the galaxies grew up together. So they both sort of formed at the same time because of this strong correlation between the size of the central bulge of the galaxy and the size of the black hole that is in it. And every well-studied galaxy, and there's, you know, millions of them, does appear to have a big black hole in the center. And I have to go with the microphone here.
Has the SETI project contributed any useful scientific information?
Not yet, but we're still hoping. So the SETI project is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and they have many different ways of looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, mostly using radio signals, but they also have some searches that are using visible light signals. And they've looked at lots of different stars, and they haven't seen any actual signals from, you know, aliens or whatever, because you would have heard about that. But what the SETI Institute did was it sort of spawned the whole interest in exoplanets. Okay, so exoplanets is a huge business in astronomy these days, studying planets in orbit around stars that are not our sun. Those are called extrasolar planets or exoplanets. And so I think one of the biggest scientific things that's come out of the SETI Institute, since they haven't obviously found aliens yet, is just this whole booming industry of studying exoplanets and trying to learn the sizes of the planets around other stars and studying other solar systems that are not our own. And just sort of, you know, we had this naive notion that all the solar systems would be just like ours. There'd be a big sun, you know, a big star in the middle, and then a big planet, and then maybe some rocky planets on the inside and some gas planets on the outside. And in fact, all of the solar systems that they're finding, and it's probably a selection effect because this is just the way the telescopes work, but most of the exoplanets that they're finding are big, hot Jupiters really close to the stars. So you couldn't have life on those because it's a gas giant and it's going around the sun every 2 days instead of every 11 years like our Jupiter does. So it's too hot, you know, for life to have been formed. But they're learning a lot about the different kinds of solar systems that are out there, and that helps you get a feeling for how rare Earth really is. You know, how rare our solar system is compared to all the other solar systems that are out there, which helps you figure out which stars are good to look at, you know, which ones might have the planets at the right place away from the star that could be called the habitable zone. And so we're learning a lot more about where to look. We just haven't seen any signals yet from anybody. Okay, here, the microphone.
Back to black holes. Magnetism is a weak force, right?
Pretty weak, yeah.
But we know that the Earth's magnetic fields are strong enough to protect us from solar winds. So when you have a black hole that has such a huge condensed core of iron, do they have really powerful magnetic fields? And if so, what effect do they have?
Okay, so the stars that have the really strong condensed cores of iron are neutron stars, actually. That's one step before a black hole. And they have really, really strong magnetic fields. And so a lot of neutron stars are seen as pulsars, and that's because they have a beam of particles coming out of them like a lighthouse as they spin around, particles and light, and so that you see a pulse as the star spins around. Those neutron stars have magnetic fields that are about at least a billion and usually a trillion Gauss. The strength of the Earth's magnetic field is a half a Gauss. Okay, so very, very strong magnetic fields. Now, black holes, because magnetic fields and electric fields are actually connected to light. In fact, light is made up of magnetic and electric fields. The black holes suck the magnetic fields in just like they suck in the light, okay, inside the event horizon. But outside the event horizon, you can still have some residual magnetic field from black holes. And it will be whatever it was from the star that collapsed to form it. But because the event horizon is out here, it's usually not as strong as the magnetic field on a neutron star. So people are trying to do those kind of measurements. But, you know, they're not, it's, you'd have bigger magnetic fields the smaller you collapse the thing down and the smaller the event horizon would be. And so the stellar mass black holes actually have stronger magnetic fields than the really big black holes in the centers of galaxies.
Apropos the cartoon you have on the screen and the text next to it, so that includes inflation. What is the size of the estimated size of the universe in light years?
Well, all we can tell you is what is the size of the observable universe, and that's, you know, that's sort of that number there.
I thought I had read somewhere that it must have been on the order of 40 million light years or something.
Oh, no, it's much bigger than that. So the most distant galaxies that we've seen are at a redshift right now at about 9, and that puts them at about 13 billion light years away. Okay, so we've seen gamma ray bursts and galaxies out as far as about 13 billion of the 13.7 billion, you know, years.
Yeah, I meant 40 billion.
Okay. So, but what is the actual size of the universe? Well, all we can tell you is what we can see. Yeah, well, I mean, you don't know this part because you can't see it. So anybody that would tell you that they do is just basing it on a model. And so, you know, that just depends on your model. As I said, it's basically the difference in scale between this 9-inch paper plate and the size of a solar system, size of our solar system.
Having knowledge and being able to teach it, are not necessarily related. Your students are very lucky.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, one more.
Hi, I'm curious about the funding for the research that's obviously going on that you must be aware of. Is the government contributing much? Are you getting money? Is anybody getting money to do the research?
Okay, so how's the funding for scientific research? Well, it was going pretty well there until the Republicans took over Congress. I'm not sure what's going to happen now. Under President Obama, the amount of money going into R&D and pure research in missions like Department of Energy, NASA, National Science Foundation, was really going up, you know, for the first time because it was severely cut back during the Bush administration. And so now I don't know what's going to happen because we're supposed to be balancing budgets and all this other stuff. So I don't really want to talk about politics, but right now I'm good. All of my education efforts are funded, you know, pretty stably for another couple years. Doesn't mean I'm not trying to get more money. I'm still trying to get money to develop my high school rocket curriculum. I haven't managed to get that one yet. And, you know, I have a few other things I'm always up my sleeve that I'm trying to work on for future projects. But I have 4 satellites that I'm getting money from. One of them isn't even launched yet. It'll be launched next year, 2012. Well, a little more than a year, February of 2012. And the other 3 are up there, and they're working great. And so I keep getting money from them. And, you know, we just keep trying to do our best to chip away at the, you know, the big problem with public ignorance of science out there. And you know, my coming here to talk to you is one of those efforts at increasing science literacy. But, you know, I give lots of talks also to schools and, you know, amateur astronomy groups. And we work with the kids in the after-school programs, and we train teachers. And we did a planetarium show about black holes. We did a NOVA show about black holes, which you can still watch on download from pbs.org. It's called Monster of the Milky Way, if you want to see it. I'm not in it, but you'll see my name in the credits. So, you know, we just try to do everything that we can to try to hook kids on science and get them excited. And if it takes rockets and things blowing up and black holes to get them excited, you know, that's fine. You know, anything, really, whatever, you know, whatever you can get to get their interest and get them to study more math and science is, you know, always what we're aiming for here. So,
great. Lynn, we want to thank you so much for your incredible presentation today. Isn't that fabulous? And we'd like to invite everybody next week to our solstice party. Starts at 10:30 right here. Please bring finger food for 4 to 6, and we can't wait to see you next week also.